Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor of TIFO Football, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. Whatever the song says, there's more than one Tottenham Hotspur. With Harry Kane, they've got drive, fluency, confidence on the ball. Without him, they're timid, palsied, ineffective. Here's the irony going into Wednesday's FA Cup tie at Goodison. Jose Mourinho self-consciously seeks to dominate his football club. He staked his reputation on winning trophies. Now Seb, he can't do that without his captain and his talisman, can he?
Certainly doesn't look like it, Mike. We're now 14 months in, and the difference between a side that contains Harry Kane and one that doesn't is actually really alarming, because obviously, you know, a world-class player, and you know, a player like that will always make a difference to a football club. But for the difference to be so pronounced and for the team to look so lost without him is it speaks to something which is really concerning, because I think it describes the lack of method which exists. I mean, we've known for a long time that Jose Mourinho's preferred method of attacking coaching is to depend on, you know, the attacking player's instincts and a kind of more ad hoc form of the game, and that's fine. But when Kane isn't there, and when his set of qualities aren't there, and when his abilities to ad-lib his way through counter-attacks, people who watched the game against West Brom will have seen his little chest control at the beginning of the second goal on Sunday. It's lovely. But without him, it's almost as if the players don't have a roadmap up the pitch. It's alarming, I think is the right word.
What about the essence of his leadership aid? You know, you've been around enough dressing rooms to have presumably come across different types of captains and leaders. His influence is obvious. You know, you look at the stats. This is his seventh successive season with 20 or more goals, 37 goals in his partnership with Son. But stats don't measure his true worth, do they?
No, probably not. No, he's a genuine leader now, isn't he? He definitely seems to inspire the players around. And we saw in the documentary that he is quite vocal behind the scenes. Maybe, you know, not a natural speaker as such, Harry Kane, but certainly someone that the players listen to. I think the main thing with Harry is that the players, no matter how badly they're playing, when Harry Kane's on the pitch, they feel that they've got a chance. They feel that he can nick them something. And when that leader, that main goal-getter is missing, then that belief wanes, clearly. That much is obvious. And we definitely saw this during his recent absence. So yeah, it's two or threefold what he brings to the table. We can see why managers at Spurs have continually played him, can't we? Because without him, they're nowhere near the same. And Seb's absolutely right. And what's changed this season is the way that he drops into midfield to sort of create a box there to spring the counters. And I think it's clever when it works, because there are quicker players ahead of him, like a Son will just go into the centre forward position. And I just feel that his all-round game has never been better, Harry Kane's, than it is right now. He's really in a great groove.
Given that, Seb, is the temptation to play him regardless, just flog him until he falls apart.
Yeah, well, I think so. There's two factors here as well, Mike. Like, yes, from a manager's perspective, he has to play because your team doesn't exist without him. But also, you've got a player on that on your hands who, if you ask him whether he wants to play, he's going to play. He also has a lot of sway in that dressing room. He also, like, if you look back over the years and to this kind of situation, almost with an identical injury with the ankle problems that he's had over probably the last 4 or 5 years, he has habitually come back a little bit early and he has generally suffered as a result of that. He's kind of, he's appeared back on the pitch. He's been starting prematurely and it's almost like he's playing catch up game by game. He hasn't had the proper conditioning before being selected. And also for a long time, you know, Harry Kane, because of Tottenham's wage structure, Harry Kane needed to play to access the sort of the bonus clauses within that deal and to, you know, to justify his staying at Spurs. So it's really tricky. I'm trying to draw an equivalent here. I don't know whether it's Wayne Rooney. I'm not sure whether it's probably a kind of a result of Kane's body type. He's a heavy guy. Like, there's a lot of pressure on his ankle joints, presumably. I'm not a medical expert, of course, but it seems dangerous. A player coming into his late 20s who's, as far as I'm aware, and maybe Aid's able to kind of to clear me up on this, but from everything I've read, the ankle is a joint that doesn't regenerate properly. It just gets weaker and weaker with every injury. And so there isn't really a case for saying, right, well, you know, if we shorten someone's recovery period and we just keep pushing him out onto the pitch because our team doesn't exist without him, that doesn't seem like it's heading for a particularly good end.
No, I know players that play with strappings around their ankles, heavy strappings for seasons on end. You know, I did it for spells in seasons. It's par for the course. You can get away with it, providing it's not going to twist every time you sort of put pressure on it. So, yeah, you can get away with it. But you're right. I don't think it regenerates like others. I was just going to ask you, Seb, do you think even though Spurs' season in terms of Premier League has fallen off a cliff, do you think that he's a real candidate for Footballer of the Year? Because I think he's got to be in the mix this year, Harry Kane, for what he's produced so far. 13 goals, 11 assists. If he can have a second half of the season as good, it would be pretty special, in my opinion. Bruno Fernandes is obviously a big candidate, but I just think that Harry might have more prolific seasons, but I don't think I've ever seen his all-round game as accomplished as it is at the moment.
I think you can make a case for him in the same way that... Do you remember when Scott Parker won Footballer of the Year? It was kind of contextual, that award, wasn't it? He wasn't the best player in the country, but what he meant to his side made him kind of credible. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I wouldn't vote for him, but I can see the point. One thing, guys, like the one parallel that's probably the right one to draw here is Marco van Basten. So obviously his career ended before he was 30, and this isn't the same kind of situation. We're not having, you know, fans volunteering their cartilage to prolong his career. But there was a really interesting, I read a really interesting interview with him a few years ago where he talked about what happened at the beginning of his career and how he felt compelled to play through pain. In fact, it was Johan Cruyff that kind of convinced him, right, well, we need you to play in European Cup competition. So I know you're injured, but you need to start games. And that was happening from his early 20s. And I'm not trying to ring any alarm bells, but it's just this timeless reminder. You got to be careful with footballers. Footballer is a proper commodity. And when it's Kane at Spurs, there is no Spurs without Kane at the moment. And you have to respect that. And I got a few friends that I was texting with over the weekend, all Tottenham supporters, and they were talking about how they feel a little bit uneasy with the idea that Jose Mourinho at the moment is the one making the decision to start him. Because there's a kind of conflict of interest there, isn't there? Because I would say that had Jose Mourinho not won that game over the weekend, his job would rightly be in question. I don't think you can, you know, West Brom are one of the worst teams in Premier League history, this West Brom. So the idea that you've got a player that's being put out on the pitch because a manager needs to bolster his job security, it's difficult. And especially when a player is that valuable as well.
Seb, you've seen this a few times in the past. Where are we in the sort of usual cycle of positivity, empty flattery, blame, disillusion and then departure that we associate with Jose Mourinho. And in that context, how important is Wednesday's FA Cup tie at Everton?
He's reached the slightly surly stage, hasn't he? He was, after the game last week, I think it was after either the Brighton game or maybe the Chelsea game, he was asked by Dan Kilpatrick from the Evening Standard about whether he was under pressure, and he gave the usual kind of, yeah, but when did this club last win a Premier League title response? And, you know, maybe I'm the guy to, you know, that kind of behaviour, which I can't tell you how disinterested a lot of Tottenham fans are in hearing that kind of stuff. So we're beginning to hear some of the older hits and some of the slightly sort of more tempestuous answers. I think the FA Cup becomes very, very important because nobody should kid themselves about the League Cup. Nobody should think that, you know, reaching the final of a League Cup and facing what looks all of a sudden like a very ominous Manchester City side is going to be enough to detract from just how dreadful they've been in the league. They had a good end to 2020. There were some good results. There were some very good results, obviously, at Old Trafford and at Man City. But to say it's been very disappointing is an understatement. So you need not just success, you need something to build on. You need something to point at and say, this is something worth persevering with. Because one of the refrains during this period is, yeah, but financial support, as it always is with Jose Mourinho, it's like, well, we need another four players there, another five over there. And you know, after three transfer windows and £500 million, everything will be fine. That's fine, because that's broadly an imperative in modern football. But what I'd say is that you have to have a reason to justify that investment. You have to show some kind of competence that's worth building on. And at the moment, that isn't there. Beyond Kane and, you know, Kane's partnership with Son, there isn't very much to like about that side. And so the FA Cup becomes a means of demonstrating that there is something worth persevering with.
Yeah, I suppose you can look to the Europa League and you might get rewarded for that slog through the early stages. Let's look specifically at Everton, if we could, Aid. Dominic Calvert-Lewin got them a point against Manchester United. Interesting to see Ronald Koeman be very complimentary speaking towards him. There's not a Barcelona transfer on the horizon, is there?
Well, they're not in the best state at the moment, are they? He probably would be. He'd be an upgrade on Braithwaite, wouldn't
yeah.
he? Look, he's a good player, Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Very, very good player. For me, as a centre forward, he's got the full package. And as a number nine, I would put him as a second behind Kane, really, in terms of English talents. Just think about his attributes. He's quick. He's one of the fastest centre forwards in the division, actually, statistically. He works hard. He's a very good finisher. Conversion rate's excellent this season. And he's also dynamite in the air, Calvert-Lewin. So, yeah, he's got everything there. And this has been a wonderful season for him. And I'm pleased for him because he had that dip, which coincided with Everton sort of wobbling as well. But yeah, he seems back in the groove. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see Calvert-Lewin and Kane on the same pitch together again. Obviously, at the start of the season, Everton did a job on Tottenham, didn't they, on the opening weekend. Wonderful performance. No doubt they'll be looking to repeat the trick. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Calvert-Lewin. I think he's going to win a lot of England caps. Mm.
I also saw, Aid, that you did a piece around Ben Godfrey. Do you think he's been their most effective signing with an appropriate shout-out, perhaps, to the intermittent impact of James?
Yeah, I mean, James has given them a bit of match-winning quality, hasn't he? But yeah, no, Ben Godfrey has been Carlo Ancelotti's most useful player. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You think about where he's played so far this season. He came into the team at right back. Right back, I think it was. Did a job there. Then he got moved to the right side of a back three when Everton went with that. And then Ancelotti went through the Tony Pulis phase of having four centre-halves and Ben Godfrey moved to the left. And for the recent game against Leeds, or the last two games, he's played centre-back finally within a back four with two different partners. And I'll tell you what, he's looked immaculate in all of those positions. He's barely put a foot wrong. Again, quick, calm, got a good defensive nose. What I said in my piece was that I can understand why there are comparisons to Rio Ferdinand. I'm not saying he's at that level yet, but I do think this is a player with great potential. and Carlo Ancelotti is bringing out that potential now. And yeah, I think he will, his value, and he wasn't cheap from Norwich, but his value will have soared this season.
Speaking of Ancelotti, Seb, he's targeted the FA Cup as almost a staging post on the way to greater glory in the years to come, perhaps. Give me your assessment of his time in charge, please.
Interesting, because I break it into two, like the tactical, technical aspect and the mentality. Because I remember watching the game over the weekend and thinking, I know there was a very famous 4-4 between these two teams a long time ago, but you remember thinking like previous generations, Everton's side, 2 down at Old Trafford. I don't think they come back from that. And then when they lose there, when they go back to 3-2, I think they fold at that point as well if they don't have the same kind of manager. And also, let's be fair, some of the same calibre of players on the pitch. It also reminded me of a game I was at way before the lockdown, which was the win they had over Watford last season when they put together one of the worst 44 minutes of football I've ever seen. And then somehow managed to be 2-2 going in at half-time. And then they won the game very late on with a Theo Walcott goal. And so I think that kind of summarises what I think of them in that, like, they're not always that impressive to watch and they have off days and they're a little bit unpredictable, but they are tougher mentally and they get points in games and in situations which previously they wouldn't have done. I also think it's very difficult to say that they'd be able to attract a player like James, for instance, or lead the market for a Doucouré type were Ancelotti not there, because... And this feeds into your question about how important the FA Cup is, Mike. If they can make hay in a competition like that, all of a sudden Everton becomes a destination for players who want to win things. And that's really important. If you want to go on attracting a James type, and I'm not suggesting that they're available all the time, but that kind of player that occupies that sort of space in the game, you become, okay, well, you know, maybe a Manchester City, Liverpool are not going to take a chance on you, but come here and you can actually achieve something. And I think that's really important. And I think Ancelotti is a big part of that. You can't argue with what he's achieved in the game. And he is a winner. I know that's a little bit of a trite description, but that's just the case. And so I think all of these things are sort of calcifying into a tougher, not necessarily, well, more ambitious because they're wealthier, but also a more optimistic Everton, I think is how I describe them.
Just quickly, you mentioned tougher mentally. That just look at their results, particularly away from home. Well, not just away from home, but the teams they've beaten Leicester, they've beaten Chelsea, they've beaten Spurs, they've beaten Arsenal. The only big team, traditional big team, they've lost to is United, and that was at home. Their only two away defeats, Southampton, Newcastle, they had big injuries at the time. Really a tough nut to crack. And you haven't always been able to say that about Everton.
True. Speaking of United, Aid, David Moyes returns to Old Trafford in midweek. Are you going to give him a bit of credit now?
I have done. I've retracted my past criticism of him before on this podcast. I didn't back him to revive his Premier League career, and he has. And do you know what? He's playing an absolute blinder this season. You cannot deny it. I love the way that he's moved from a back five to a back four, and it's really settled. And Creswell is a player rejuvenated, deserves a lot of credit for that. Obviously, the recruitment of Sofal and Suchek was fantastic. Great base. It was a tough decision to take Mark Noble out of the regular starting 11, but he did it, and it's been the right call. And then in the positions up front, not with a striker, obviously Antonio's the only striker, but in those three attacking midfield positions, he's got really good competition for places, so they're keeping everybody on their toes. I think he's ticked all the boxes this season, David Moyes, in terms of doing things right. I even think the decision to bring in Kevin Nolan was a smart one. Obviously, it didn't work out for him as a manager, Kev, but having someone younger inside that dressing room, because obviously there's David Moyes and Stuart Pearce, having someone younger in that dressing room, I think was a smart move, just someone more relatable to the players that can bridge that generation gap. And yeah, they're doing fantastically well. Probably go out to Manchester United, but they won't just go there this time and hope for damage limitation as a Moyes team has done before. I think they'll go there a little bit like Everton and be competitive. And that's all West Ham fans want, home or away, be competitive, try to win. And my criticism of him before was that he was defeatist in his tactical approach, but that's not the case now.
Yeah, okay, well, I better apologise for a double red card offence there. speaking of which, we've got to mention Souček's red card by Mike Dean. Seb, why aren't referees judged on merit?
Well, this is a strange thing, because the way the PGMOL selects match officials for different fixtures is based on a league table. They rank their individual decisions, and that includes linesmen as well. They go through every decision a referee makes or fails to make during a game, and they kind of have an internal little ranking system, which isn't available to the public, of course, and they sort of move up and down. I don't really enjoy the kind of the finger pointing. I've been drawn into it probably, you know, as a result maybe of lockdown and becoming, you know, sort of frustrated with other aspects of life, of course. But it's really difficult to defend those two decisions. The Mitrovic-Souček incident, I tell you what it is. It's the difference between, is that actually worth a red card, or is it an opportunity to show one? Because those are two different things. It's a, if a kind of a member of a public looks at that, I think they know full well what's happening. Souček is surely just trying to escape a grapple, and there's been a little bit of contact. And Mitrovic, who was all sort of, he went to kind of player union after the game, well, maybe doesn't roll around on the floor and get his opponent sent off. I mean, you can't have it both ways. Like, either you're...
He needs to be called out for that, doesn't he?
Well, I think so. Like, I appreciate the fact that he's gone to bat for Souček after the fact, but he's also got him sent off, really. It doesn't excuse the error of the referee, and how I still don't understand how the decision's been made, really. But it's just a very strange incident. It was kind of like a suspension of common sense, wasn't it? It was bizarre.
I would describe it as laughable, but it's the least funny decision I've ever seen, because it is worrying. It is alarming that one of our so-called top officials can deem that a red card offence. Now, for me, referees have got into a horrendous habit of punishing first. The instinct is to punish. Now, for me, a red card or a penalty should be kind of the last resort, in terms of I'm left with no option. That is a penalty. I'm left with no option. That has to be a red card. I think that the threshold has gone way too low. And they're just too eager. They're just too eager to make these decisions.
I don't know what you guys think about this, and I don't want to come across, I don't want to be an old man about this, but when I was growing up, and when I watched football on television, and when I went to football, it was always kind of the unwritten rule that a red card was a last resort. It was the thing that everybody wanted to avoid happening, and it would happen. Like, I know that there've always been bad tackles in the game, and that they've always been sending offs for as long as anyone can remember. And, you know, there've always been players that have bent rules. Now it feels like we're in a situation where you have to avoid giving an official the opportunity to have a moment in a game, like to have this kind of to alter the course of a match. And I feel like, in a way, you have to reclaim that balance, because we don't want to talk about referees all the time. I know it's a little bit of an hypocrisy, but because that's what we're doing. But you don't want to have this on a Monday morning.
I genuinely think that everybody at the PGMOL, including the bosses, need to go on a refresher course. Seriously, because they've got bogged down. They've gone down into this black hole of any kind of minute contact has to constitute a penalty, and the red card threshold is so wafer thin at the moment. They need, forget the rule book, they need to take advice and just talk to people in the game, talk to managers, talk to players, talk to former players, get in a room and say, what is this? Is this a penalty? Is this a red card? And I think they will learn a lot. They've got bogged down in their own bureaucracy, and they've never been worse.
We're changing interpretations in the middle of a season. I was watching Newcastle-Southampton over the weekend, and that Southampton goal, which was disallowed, that would have counted 3 weeks ago. Like, that is ridiculous. We've been normalised to this kind of, you know, we'll do anything we can to avoid the mea culpa, which is, right, we'll change the interpretation, and, you know, this was actually correct because X, Y, Z, but as of tomorrow, it won't be because we've I mean, it's just nonsense. Like, you can't keep up. And if I can't keep up as just someone that's watching the game, how can players keep up? How can coaches? You can't do this. You can't tweak the rule book in the middle of a season because it becomes a competitive, it becomes a credibility issue.
Yeah, I think the other thing that we're all forgetting or in danger of forgetting, mainly because of VAR, I suspect, is that football is a game of human fallibility. And I suppose we've seen that. You know, we accept that in players and it comes and it goes. If you take Manchester United as an example, Aid, David De Gea, you know, he has become increasingly fallible. Managers are judged by big decisions. If you remember Fergie and Jim Leighton in the 1990 FA Cup final, is it time to drop De Gea and give Dean Henderson a run?
I think it's time to drop De Gea because Manchester United have two number ones. If the number two was considerably weaker, you'd maybe give him another chance. But Henderson is so good that there can't be too much in it. And I think you have to be a bit bolder if you're only going to Solskjaer. I've loved David De Gea. I think he's been an amazing Premier League goalkeeper down the years. But the truth is, he's gone soft. He's one of the least brave keepers I've seen in many years, actually. And I'm not the only one that can see that. Opposition teams can see that. And he's now being maybe viewed as someone that doesn't fancy it, doesn't fancy 50-50s. When he comes off his line, he doesn't commit himself. He hesitates. So that's the problem that he's got to fix. And I think Ollie has got to drum it home to him that he's, you know, his career as a world-class goalkeeper is on the line unless he toughens up. But yeah, for me, in the short term, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has to make a tough decision and leave him out. I think Henderson could easily have started this season based on what he did at Sheffield United anyway. So yeah, give him a go. He hasn't been disastrous, but when you've got a backup as good as Henderson, it shouldn't take that much to change things.
Yeah, is there a sense, Seb, of cracks being papered over? If you think about Maguire's vulnerability on the turn, maybe a lack of consistent centre-back partnership, we're still looking for who their best defensive midfield player is. Was Ollie basically stating the obvious when he said, look, we're not title challengers?
It's hard to say because I think that's a kind of a default answer in that situation for anybody. I mean, Jurgen Klopp was saying that when he was sort of 400 points clear last season. So I think he must be aware that there are there are issues within his side, like the defence. Lindelof, he's a funny player, isn't he? Like you can watch him in one half and think he's quite convincing, and then there's something quite frantic and jerky about his style that makes it a little bit unsettling to watch him defend. And I think Solskjaer's aware of that. I don't think they did the business they wanted to do over the summer. Clearly their main target was Jadon Sancho, and that didn't happen. And it didn't happen at the cost of, you know, other things which needed to occur. So I think it's fair, and I think he recognises that there are parts that need to be rebuilt. But I would say also that, you know, that's kind of a separate issue to, well, how is he managing some of these games? If you look at some of his substitutions and when they come in games and how he responds, hey, listen, how he responds to the goalkeeping issue. You know, David De Gea cost them points against Sheffield United. Whether that goal should have been allowed or not, it's kind of irrelevant. He should have come for that cross, which made it 1-0. Cost them points at the weekend, which would have put them within touching distance of Man City. So there's a hesitation over some of these important issues, and that seems to be a theme throughout his management. So yeah, there's a multitude of issues. There's not one diagnosis for why United aren't quite where they should be. But yeah, these are things that need solving.
With Manchester City, Aid, let's not go too far over the top. Well, actually, on second thoughts, let's go over the top. Are they capable of winning all four that they're in? League Cup, FA Cup, Premier League, Champions League?
More capable this season than they were last season and the season before because they're not making the same mistakes. Defensively, they're not giving up the chances that they were. And for that reason, we have to view City as a different beast now. They're no longer just the swashbuckling team going forward. They're also the team that are hard to create chances against. So, yes, well, they'll be overwhelming favourites to win the League Cup. FA Cup, yeah, I think they'll be favourites for that. Obviously, the Premier League, they're in pole position, and this isn't a vintage Champions League, is it? I don't think the European giants are anything special this season. So yeah, after what was a really sort of low key start to the campaign, where none of us were going overboard about them, they're coming with a quite stunning run, aren't they? And you've got to remember that 4-1 win at Liverpool, which could have been 5, obviously, with a penalty, was done without their best player, Kevin De Bruyne. So, and also without a striker. So, I mean, it is a little bit scary, isn't it? The way that they're going. I think that Gundogan is absolutely key in terms of adding those goals from midfield. But not just that, when they don't have the ball, we know that he can be a defensive midfielder. So he's the two players rolled into one. Cancelo is two players rolled into one. He's a right back and also a central midfielder that allows Gundogan to push on. Foden is a playmaker, a winger, a false nine, all rolled into one. They've just got a lot of unpredictable yet brilliant players. And yeah, credit where credit's due. Pep Guardiola has regenerated the team this season, and they're better.
His handling of Phil Foden in particular has basically proved a lot of us wrong, hasn't it, Seb? He's obviously been following a long-term strategy with him and was rewarded at Anfield with what basically was a coming-of-age performance.
Yeah, I think a lot of us got greedy, myself included, in wanting to see him and wanting to see him, you know, bedded into that side, probably prematurely. And we've all been proven wrong. I think I looked it up last night, and I think he's played fewer than 60 Premier League games since 2017, which is, I mean, that does require some patience when you've got a talent like that. But it was one of those moments where you can't help but be excited when a player's talent kind of transcends his team, and you just think, goodness me, like his goal at Anfield was, it's amazing to watch a player do so many actions on the ball in such a short space of time. It's like a blow. It's like Eden Hazard used to do that. Like he would change directions 4 or 5 times and then unleash a shot, and it would all happen within a split second, and no one really has any time to react to it. He did that. I mean, he did that for the first goal when he kind of knotted up Trent Alexander-Arnold a little bit and created space for created the shot that would that Gundogan would turn in, and then did the same on the other side to Robertson, who he made look like he'd started 23 games this season. He just looked absolutely shattered, but you know, it was merciless, and it was just a fabulous performance.
Mm. They're at Swansea on Wednesday. Aid Steve Cooper. In many ways, he's a very modern coach, nurtured by the development system. You know, his England background helps in the recruitment of younger players. What about senior pros? Do they have less respect on someone from that type of background? And do you think he can carry his influence over to the Premier League? Because Swansea do look like they might go up.
You earn your respect as a manager inside the dressing room. Even big name managers, when they come into a new club, you're starting afresh because all eyes are on you, and players young and old are looking towards you to see whether you know what you're talking about and to see whether your decision making is good. As Steve Cooper has earned that respect at Swansea, he's doing a brilliant job. And yeah, he's not just a coach of young players. I think that he's a really sound tactician, full stop. And what's impressed me most about Swansea and Steve Cooper this year is the fact that he recognised that they were a bit too raw, a bit too young last season. And he's gone and brought in some more experienced players. Conor Hourihan has come in and been excellent. Jamal Lowe, who's not old, but has got lots of championship experience, has come in and been brilliant. Ryan Bennett as well, player that sort of hasn't really made it in the Premier League, but he's shone for them. And he's blended those guys in with these good young players, and that they're a quality team. Back three, they'll go against Manchester City. It's pretty much always a 3-4-1-2 with them. And they're totally in sync. It's one of those teams at the moment where everything's coming naturally. Obviously, there'll be huge underdogs in the game, but they are in a lovely groove. And yeah, I think Swansea could easily be a Premier League club next season. And Cooper could be one of these managers that we talk about in the same breath as a Graham Potter, really.
Well, on Graham Potter, Seb, you know, Pep praised him as his, in his view, the best English coach at the moment. Dan Ashworth, his technical director, talks about his development of young players and an ability to play attractive football within a budget. It's going to be interesting on Wednesday at the King Power because it's inevitable there's going to be comparisons made between him and Brendan Rodgers.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. I think it might be a little bit premature because Graham Potter and Brendan Rodgers have kind of operated it in different areas of the game. There's a kind of overlap now because they're both working in the Premier League. But it's similar, isn't it? It seems to be based on improving players and giving opportunities to young players. There's a nice little neat comparison between, I know he's been injured, but Tarek Lamptey on Brian's right, on the right side of Brian's defence, and James Justin on the left side of Leicester's. I think James Justin's an excellent player. He's one of the best right-footed left backs I've seen since probably Dennis Irwin. He looks outstanding. It was interesting because I was listening to Steve Sidwell speak over the weekend about Ashworth's kind of, I mean, he had England DNA, I suppose Brighton DNA, where he wanted, if someone was watching a Brighton game from space, he wanted people to be able to identify who was Brighton by the style that they were employing with the ball and without the ball, and to kind of have that sort of homogeneity of approach. It's very, very interesting stuff. And I think Potter is a... Potter's a really good component within that sort of system. And I'd liken it again to England because Gareth Southgate, on his coaching merits, probably shouldn't have been England head coach, but he did good things because he fitted the system. And the same is true, really, of Graham Potter. Like, there wouldn't be many Premier League clubs that would have said, right, on the basis of your CV, this is where you belong and we're going to give you this opportunity. But they evidently saw someone that could create a native culture that could kind of take charge of some of the intangibles that exist within a football club, but could also, you know, have the kind of... I think one of the things that Graham Potter probably doesn't get enough credit for is that he hasn't panicked. So for a lot of this season, he's coached a style of football which has drawn plaudits and produced some decent performances, but hasn't produced many points. And yet there's no wavering. And I think that's a real coaching strength, especially these days when, like, you're never less than three games away from like a tantrum from your supporters. And he's remained very loyal to his own approach.
Trust the process. It's the old boring old cliche, isn't it? But I think he's got the players trusting his process. And the confidence shines through, doesn't it? When Brighton play a big team, even we saw it against Liverpool, see with that win, there's no inferiority complex. There's no damage limitation. It's like, we're going to play our game and we think we can be a match for you. And yeah, you need everyone on board. But I think the same as what I just said about earning respect, he went into Brighton and earned the respect clearly instantly, because within weeks, a team that had played cautious defensive football were knocking the ball around at the back with unbelievable self-belief. So yeah, he's a quality coach. Can't deny that.
I wonder where the... I mean, I was watching their game against Spurs a couple of weeks ago. That point about buy-in aid is perfect, because you saw two teams face each other and no doubt, like, on a player-by-player basis, Tottenham was stronger, and yet you saw the difference between a team that knew what they were supposed to be doing and believed in what they were supposed to be doing and a team that clearly didn't. And that's a huge advantage to have. And yeah, it speaks volumes about the coach that his players react to him like that.
As does Leicester's performance under Rodgers, who's always struck me as being an underestimated man manager.
Yeah, I think players like Brendan Rodgers. It's we take the Mickey sometimes in the media, but I like him. I've always rated him. I've always kind of liked his confidence, and I like the style and of his teams. I really do. And yeah, man management. I mean, you just don't hear of any problems, do you, at Leicester? I mean, Jamie Vardy, he's a big character within that dressing room, and he's managed him staggeringly well, hasn't he? And you know, Kasper Schmeichel is a guy that can sort of manage the team from the back, I suppose. The same with Johnny Evans, but yeah, Brendan Rodgers, I think is right up there, pound for pound. I think he's fast becoming, if not already, an elite coach.
Do you think maybe the way that he was treated by some of the media, I think that did him good. honestly, I think Brendan Rodgers version one needed to have not his wings clipped, but needed to suffer a little bit of gentle mockery, because there were times when his personality was problematic, and there were times actually when I think his personality probably caused a few issues with players. We remember that infamous Liverpool documentary, and the things he would say sometimes, occasionally they set his teams up for fools. That was particularly true at Liverpool, and the new version of him, you kind of, with all of that stripped away, we're able to say, goodness, what a good coach he is and how effective he is at managing young players. And so it's been to his benefit. I dare say it's been unpleasant at times, but it's worked out.
Just look at the energy of Leicester's team. Just look at the way they work, with and without the ball. James Maddison's obviously a great example with his enthusiasm to play for Rodgers, but Not the other teammates don't speak as well as James Maddison, but just look at them. Look at the way they're running around the pitch, working for each other. There's a massive hunger there. And again, there's a belief. Leicester, I firmly believe that Leicester dressing room believe they're in a title race. They think they can win the Premier League this season. And I think that they can definitely win the FA Cup if they put their mind to it. So, yeah, this could be an amazing season for the Foxes.
What about the king of stand-up, Sean Dyche? Are Burnley durable enough for a long cut run in what's, you know, pretty much a remorseless season?
I think they could be, but I don't think they will be. I think given their placing in the league, I think, and, you know, Fulham getting better. I mean, they're not really within touching distance, but they are an improving side. I think for Burnley, especially given their takeover, priorities are clearly going to be the Premier League. Also, given some of the questions about their takeover and some of the potential red flags that have been raised there, I think it just becomes about league survival again. They could be. I mean, it would actually be very nice for someone like Sean Dyche to win an FA Cup, because that group of players is very capable of at least getting to a quarter or semi-final and then being in the draw. I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but you could see something happening. I mean, they cause upsets on a regular enough basis in the Premier League to be a contender in a cup competition. But I think it will come down to resources and ultimately having a relatively narrow group of players.
You've got Bournemouth at Turf Moor on Tuesday. One of the nicer stories over the last couple of weeks has been Jack Wilshere, a couple of goals as he's bedded in at Bournemouth. No one's ever doubted his talent, Aid. What sort of career do you see ahead of him?
Oh, it's a good question. It all depends, doesn't it, on his body and how it stands up to the rigours of regular football. When he's fit and healthy, he's a classy midfielder. We know that. We saw that at the weekend. I don't know if you've seen the Bournemouth goals. Wonderful assist, just slips past a player and plays the through ball for one and scores actually with a header with another. You know, this is a player that didn't have a club, unbelievably, until a few weeks ago. So now, I mean, I love the fact that he's been humble enough to take the chance at Bournemouth and to try and rebuild. And who knows? We might yet see him in the Premier League again. We might see him. It just depends. Talent-wise, he's good enough. It's just about whether he can stay fit. But look, this would be an interesting game, because for me, Bournemouth have a better, or have the equal of Burnley in terms of attacking talent. The players that went down, a lot of them stayed. You've got Brooks and Wilshere, and you've got a lot of others there that are more than capable of causing Burnley problems. The difference for Bournemouth is they don't have Burnley's defence or organisation. They've been a bit shambolic at the back. And I think that's probably why Jason Tindall lost his job, even though I thought it was harsh. A lot of Cherry supporters, when I tweeted that, got on my back and were saying, no, we've not been very good. So, yeah, interesting game and a bit of an audition, really, for Jonathan Woodgate. I don't know whether he's in the frame to get the gig permanently, but he's got an opportunity to cause an upset. And do you know what? It wouldn't surprise me if Bournemouth did cause an upset here, because Burnley haven't been a cup team under Sean Dyche.
Mm-hmm. What about Barnsley? They're a singular club, usually punch above their weight. Surely they're not capable of upsetting Chelsea, are they?
They're a nightmare to play against, Mike. Honestly, obviously talent-wise, not on the same level as Chelsea, but they're the best pressers in the Championship. They will swarm all over Chelsea, given the chance, and make life hard for them. They've got some good players. Woodrow up front is a match winner. Mauer in midfield, I like. Left wing back Styles. They've got talent. Yeah, unfortunately at the back three, I think they could get torn apart really by a team like Chelsea. So yeah, I wouldn't give them too much hope. But for half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, they can frustrate Chelsea. But beyond that, I don't think so.
The other type is sort of the crisis of confidence derby, isn't it, Seb? Southampton at Wolves on Thursday. Southampton still look shell-shocked to me.
As you'd expect, I think. I don't know what it is to lose a professional game 9-0. Unfortunately, I had a few experiences of that, like schoolboy football, and it wasn't great there either, in front of like six people. I think what alarmed me actually about Saturday was that they didn't actually have a shot on target after Newcastle went down to nine men. And I know it's difficult to play against a low block. I know that gets a little bit harder when you're playing on a sodden pitch and you can't move the ball around quickly enough. But the same kind of chemistry, like Danny Ings has kind of dropped off in potency. Shea Adams has actually greatly improved from last season, and his link-up play is a lot better than it was. But it's not quite the same. Nathan Redmond isn't quite in sync. I know he's had a bit of an injury. So it's difficult. Wolves, I've got fewer concerns about. I think William Jose is he's made a difference. I know he hasn't scored yet, but they've looked like a more cohesive attacking unit since he came into the side. I think Pedro Neto is starting to play really, really well. He's been one of my favourite players to watch this season. And the defence is steadily improving. You know, Wolves could very nearly have nicked that game against Leicester and they were in it all the way through. Were it not for like a Kasper Schmeichel save, then they would have done. So I don't know. I think Wolves are on their way out of it. I think you're right. It is a little bit of a crisis of confidence derby, but two teams at different stages of their recovery from it. So I quite like Wolves to nick it. And it's funny, isn't it? Because I'm a huge fan of Ralf Hasenhüttl. And that's probably the only time I've ever said that about a manager that's lost two games 9-0 in the Premier League. And it's just, what is the fatal flaw there? Like, what is the kind of, where is the susceptibility? Because it's not just getting a man sent off. That's not an excuse to lose by nine goals. It seems like it seems to describe almost a stubbornness of coaching.
I think they started to feel sorry for themselves in that game.
And yeah, maybe.
Because they've had no options on the bench. Injuries have hit them massively. Yeah, I think they just felt a bit hard done by. And yeah, it was worrying how they collapsed again. Well, for Wolves, so for Southampton, the injuries have definitely dented them and their consistency at the back. But Wolves are starting to get players back. I noticed Johnny, the left wing back, played, didn't he, against Leicester. And I think that Johnny makes a big difference. For me, Wolves have to be back three. They have to be a back five team. They've tried out the back four, but they don't look the same. I mean, Arsenal should have been three up before before what happened at Molineux. That they were quite worrying, Wolves. But when they play in a back three, I'm far less worried.
One other tie. Sheffield United against Bristol City. We almost forgot Sheffield United were playing Chelsea on Sunday night because it was obviously overshadowed by the fallout from Liverpool's defeat by Manchester City. Seb, looking at that, do you think now Liverpool will concentrate on the Champions League? And if you look at some of the flaws in that performance, specifically Alisson, is that the sort of game you just bin it? It's a distraction. You've made your mistakes. You know, there's not that much to learn from them.
Yeah, I think so, because I mean, there were a lot of mental mistakes in that game, not just from Alisson. I thought some of the defending out wide was really poor. The inability of the midfield to protect those two fullbacks was really disappointing as well. I'm split really, Mike, because in one sense, yes, you need your goalkeeper to forget he's had a day like that, fairly obviously and for obvious reasons. At the same time, though, I wonder whether there aren't some things to take from it, which is that I don't know whether Jurgen Klopp has handled this period particularly well. And that's said with all deference to what's been achieved. Liverpool have had a magnificent 3 years, and what he's done in that city is amazing. And none of what I'm about to say affects that. Nevertheless, I feel like there's been a few too many attacks on broadcasters, a few too many spiky interviews. I felt like his barb about Manchester City's 2-week break was maybe fair, maybe, you know, entirely justified, and he had a point. They did have an easier schedule. But is that really the best way to prepare a group of players for a game like that, is kind of to give them the ready-made excuse? I don't know enough about psychology to answer that properly, but what I do know is that this has been a different Jurgen Klopp to the one we've seen over the last few years, and that the character that he's played, the character that he's been, and the kind of the effect that he's had on the players, it seems different to what it was. And now you're seeing players like Virgil van Dijk, for instance, I think is as talented a centre half as I've seen for a really long time, and the effect of his loss is not just felt in defence. I mean, you don't just have a hole in the centre of your backline because he's injured. You feel the effects in your distribution and the way that you plot your way up the field and your exits, and also all the intangibles. He's a leader, he's a player that other players are inspired by, and nevertheless it's felt like a much bigger problem than it needed to have been. And again, I accept that there have been other players missing, but it feels poorly handled. I don't know if I'm being harsh, but and maybe this is, yes, an afternoon to forget, but also maybe there's something to learn from what happened over, not just in that game, but the games prior, the losses to Brighton, the losses to Burnley. Liverpool have enough players to survive those games and to have produced better performances than they ultimately did. And it's not a terminal situation. Let's not be melodramatic, but I feel like something needs to be tweaked there.
They've got 8 days to prepare for the Champions League leg first leg against Leipzig. That's going to be in Budapest, Aid. Is that modern football? No fans, so you can play anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, we kick off at times that we never thought we'd kick off at, don't we? You know, 6 o'clock kickoffs. I mean, that was unheard of before. We just got to adapt, haven't we, to the situation. It's not great, is it, for the integrity of the competition? It certainly won't help Leipzig, you'd imagine. And it's never good when politics, you know, international politics sort of interfere with football. But we know, if we want to play on in a pandemic, we've got to just take these things on the chin and roll with it, haven't we? It's just one of those things. It should be a good tie, because both teams have mistakes in them this season, and you would imagine it could be a two-legger that features a few goals.
Yeah, talking of modern football, Champions League proposals for 2024 are going to be talked about on Tuesday, a meeting of UEFA. The proposal is you've got 36 teams all playing 10 games before the knockout phase. Just let's end by just running through this. Seb, is this the Greed League Mark II?
Of course. We want a bigger share of the cake, bigger share of the pie. It always has been that. It's, if you think about what 10 games would actually look like in reality, and how it would potentially disenfranchise, you know, a big proportion of fixtures, it would make, you know, create a whole load of dead rubbers potentially, then it's not in the interest of the fans, is it? I mean, it's also not in the interest of supporters to build in another set of European away days in the middle of a week. So times are a little bit unusual at the moment, but under normal circumstances, which we'd hope it would be by 2024, it's another set of flights, another set of hotels, another set of long train journeys, another, you know, set of huge costs. Whose interest does this serve? Is it the fans that have been part of a club's journey to this level of the game? Or is it sort of a generic imagined fan from anywhere in the world who can just, as long as they can pay the bill, that's all that matters. And as long as they're, you know, buying the official betting partners and the official beer. This is not how it's supposed to be. I know I get really ranty whenever this comes up, but it just winds me up because it's so, so selfish. And there really is no other word for it.
If any of our clubs vote for this, the next time they dare to moan about player welfare, about overplaying their players and about fixture congestion, I want an interviewer to throw this back in their face. Yeah, but you voted for 100 extra matches in the Champions League. It will go from 125 games to 225. You voted for that. Surely you now forfeit the right to complain about player welfare, because it just doesn't sit right with me in this time where we're really worried about footballers and we need to protect them because we're going to burn them out, we're going to shorten their careers. Lumping on a load of extra games is just not on, in my opinion. It's greed gone too far.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Just bear with me on this one. Try and think of the Champions League as a luxury car, the sort of car that we can't afford, probably. It's got all the bells, all the whistles. It accelerates from 0 to 80 in a blink of an eye. Now, what would happen if, simply to make more money, the makers added a fifth wheel? Performance would suffer. It would look silly. And customers would be driven away. Now, that's exactly what UEFA is planning to appease the biggest clubs. They should be careful what they wish for. And they should leave the Champions League as it is. It's not perfect, but it's pretty serviceable. Do you agree? Please let me know. And in the meantime, thanks to Adrian and Seb, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.